Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Wednesday, December 11th. Avian flu in Hilo? Wastewater sampling turns up positive. What could this mean for our native birds? And we've all been there, you know the feeling, the DMV dread. Getting your driver's license renewed or for the first time can be a hassle. So what's changed? Well, we hope for the better. And the curtain has gone up on the new Cirque du Soleil Hawaii show. We hanaho an interview with the show's music director about the local talent involved in staging this production. The detection of avian flu in a Hilo wastewater treatment plant is another sign that the disease is spreading here in the islands. The State Department of Health says risk to humans is low, in part because the type of virus circulating is different from the one on the mainland that's causing occasional human infection. Jason Omick is a wildlife biologist with the Division of Forestry and Wildlife at the State Department of Land and Natural Resources. He spoke with the Conversation's Maddie Bender this morning about the latest news out of Hilo.
The news that came out yesterday that H5 avian influenza was detected in wastewater samples in Hilo. What are your preliminary reactions to that? What are you thinking about with respect to the wildlife there?
We don't know how serious the threat is right now. What that kind of means for us is we kind of have to get into gear and get staff versed on the situation. So currently we're monitoring the situation and testing carcasses that we may find for avian influenza. We're preparing staff and partners in case the virus spreads and purchasing personal protection equipment, providing training and working on establishing quarantine facilities and talking with rehabbers that wildlife may be going to. And maybe they can possibly set up some sort of quarantine situation in their facility. But we're also in discussions with the Fish and Wildlife Service on the potential for trailing avian influenza vaccines used on the mainland. But these discussions are still preliminary. If the virus starts spreading even more, we'll start to deploy staff for response and assistance in as the situation evolves. But currently, right now, it's more of a monitoring type of situation. As we're out working in the field, we'll look for these signs and respond as necessary, get these carcasses to someone to test if there's multiple carcasses there, whether they're native or non-native species, to kind of see where that is. Seabirds and waterbirds are at high risk of infection and the spread of disease due to the colonial nature and the proximity they have to other migratory birds that may be affected. So if this disease does spread to these species, we're going to have to continue monitoring, considering human safety first. We're unable to prevent a spread of this disease, but we'll try to minimize the situation as we can on our lands and elsewhere. You know, and if the quarantine facilities are available, we'll try to bring those sick birds there for care, and we'll address each situation case by case kind of basis.
And just to emphasize, we are talking about the spread of the virus in birds specifically, because the risk to humans is low. Part of the reason of that is because this seems to be, at least on Oahu, a different clade than the one that we're seeing among, for instance, dairy cows on the U.S. mainland.
Yeah, that's what we're seeing right now, for sure. For chickens, the mortality rate can be 100%, but yeah, that would be correct. We're not seeing it anywhere else or thinking that it may jump to mammals or anything like that.
And do you happen to have numbers when you say you're testing carcasses and preparing staff?
So right now, folks are, if they do have a detection or find a bunch of dead carcasses or something like that, they're to call the Department of Agriculture. So we're working together with them for poultry animals or backyard animals, those type of situations. Department of Agriculture will respond to that call and, you know, investigate. You know, when it comes to wild birds or native species, they're pushing those calls to us. And so they'll log that information, call us, we'll log it too. And so right now we're both logging calls that may be coming in and sharing that information once a week. But right now, the calls that are coming in are pretty low. We've had a few calls on dead birds in the area. I think all of them have tested negative. And so we're sharing information together between departments right at the moment.
And I guess something that it seems like people in the native bird conservation space are quite worried about with avian flu is just that we don't know what the impact could be. So from your end, how do we figure out whether or not this virus is going to be a big problem for our forest birds and also other birds like the nene?
Yeah, that is a very good question. We don't know because this is something new here. And so if we see outbreaks in a wetland or anything like that, we're going to remove those carcasses from the area to stop other things like botulism. You know, we can't stop the spread of something like this, but we can mitigate it by removing those wildlife from those areas, making sure, you know, infected wildlife doesn't go into rehab clinics where they're trying to work with injured or sick wildlife. And so understanding the signs and making sure that staff are vigilant when they're out in the field, you know, noticing these things, making sure the public understands that this is out there and for people to get notified so we can document it, let's say hot spots or something like that. And these type of viruses can be treated similar to a human flu. And so animals can be treated, but they would have to be quarantined and away from, you know, other wildlife. But the main thing is the slowing down that human interaction with wild birds, you know, feeding wild birds, holding wild birds, things like that, which you shouldn't be doing anyways. People need to understand, like, you know, as you're feeding these birds, they're going to congregate. There's more birds in one spot and one of them could have a flu and you could be contributing to that. So I think the main takeaway is, you know, to kind of just keep your distance from birds. If you find a dead bird, you know, there's a process which you can read on the Department of Agriculture's website on how to dispose of the bird, picking it up, double bagging it, putting it in the trash and getting it out of the environment. And then again, there's a response if there's multiple species found there or multiple of the same species found in an area that are dead to put that call into the Department of Agriculture. And if it's a native species, you know, that will get routed to us and, you know, we'll respond accordingly.
And in terms of signs and symptoms, we spoke yesterday to Susan Wilkinson, who runs Susie's Duck Sanctuary, who unfortunately had a really tragic situation with her birds there. And she was talking about some of the symptoms she was noticing in her birds that ultimately tested positive for H5N1. And that included things like eye infections, lethargy, loss of appetite. But anything when people see possibly diseased or dead birds that they should look for?
Yeah, I mean, if it's dead, you're not going to be able to see anything, you know, but if it is alive, yeah, those symptoms that you just spoke about, and some birds may not show any symptoms whatsoever. So it's really like if they have it and they are being lethargic and you see lesions and things like that, at that point, you can possibly say it's a possibility they may have that, but you wouldn't know unless you're tested. So it's kind of stay away. That can be reported. You know, but really we're looking for dead birds. If dead birds are being found, they have to be reported so we can go and investigate and sample.
And switching gears for a second, because you also work coordinating the Game Commission and it's hunting season. So anything in particular that hunters should know and be aware of?
I would say we are in the tail end of game bird season, which ends at the end of January. We're not seeing any signs of sick or dead game birds in the environment, but I would say if you are out there doing game bird hunting, if you're going to be harvesting wild birds, obviously don't do it if you see the bird is sick or if it's dead. I would not collect that bird. I would possibly bring disposable gloves when you're handling or cleaning the game and washing your hands with soap and water immediately afterwards. If soap and water is not available, you can use some alcohol-based hand sanitizers. I would dress your birds that you did get in your hunt in the field. You may have pets at home. You may have poultry at home. Who knows? So I would clean that bird in the field. People use tools to clean these animals. I would also make sure that those tools are cleaned and kept maybe separately during this time. And bag the other stuff that you're going to be throwing away, you know. But I think the main take home on that is just to be clean while you're working with your harvest and making sure you clean your hands afterwards.
Is there anything about this situation that you're worried about that keeps you up at night that you just want to figure out?
Yeah, I mean, the fact that it can get into our native bird species could be a major problem. And so we do not want to see this thing take off. we've seen what's happened in the mainland and, you know, quite larger of an outbreak. I would just say I'm not super alarmed at the moment. Like if we started seeing a bunch of things popping up, it may trigger me. But, you know, the fact that we are on an island and it's in the environment right now, it's a red flag for us. I mean, this could have a devastating effect on our native bird species. We do not want to see that happening. So I think if people follow the right protocols when dealing with wildlife, not out there feeding wildlife and getting them to congregate, and staff and the public just being vigilant about providing notification if they do see these symptoms in the wild, while they're hiking, while they're hunting, while they're driving down the street, to report these things so we can really have a good eye on monitoring the progress.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time.
Great. Thank you for having me.
That was Jason Omick, a wildlife biologist with the Department of Land and Natural Resources, talking with HPR's Maddie Bender. We'll be hearing from a scientist tomorrow about the possible risk to our monk seals. Here's a bit of election news you might have missed. The Honolulu Zoo recently elected a new mayor in a landslide victory. A native short-eared owl named Makamai was chosen to lead the zoo's highest office. Honolulu Mayor Rick Blangiardi has congratulated Honolulu Zoo Mayor Makamai and says his administration looks forward to collaboration on issues like education and climate change. We've got the call of the short-eared owl on today's Mana Minute. Here's University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart.
The pueo, or Hawaiian short-eared owl, is our only native owl and is important in Hawaiian culture as an aumakua. Pueo are active mainly during the day, unlike the more common barn owl, which is mostly seen at night and has a striking white face. Pueo spend a majority of their time soaring over open grassy areas hunting for small mammals such as mice and rats. They're doing well on most of the Hawaiian islands, but it's becoming more difficult to hear the call of the pueo on Oahu, where they're considered an endangered subspecies. For Hawaii Public Radio, I'm Patrick Hart from the Biology Department at UH Hilo.
Support for Manu Minute comes from Evergreen by Deborah. At evergreenbydeborah.com, learn more about porcelain tile by Royal Mosa, made using recycled water and hydroelectric power to create floor and wall tiles inspired by trends in design and architecture.
Starting today, anyone across the state needing to take a test to get a driver's license or learner's permit will be able to do it online. Heads up to licensed drivers and wannabe drivers. It's all part of a pilot project that's launching due to the extraordinary number of expiring licenses over the next 2 years. Here on Oahu, between 500 to 600 people need to take the written test every week. That number is about to explode from 84,000 to more than 106,000 a year in 2025, which is a 30% increase. And on top of that, in 2026, officials are bracing for an additional 30% jump. Yep, the demand is through the roof. Kim Ashiro is the new head of the city's customer services department. She explains how the new online system will work and the story behind why the demand is skyrocketing.
Right now, for the permit test, all applicants need to go into a driver's license office statewide and take a written test. So this is on pieces of paper. It's 30 questions coming out of the state driver's manual. That's what we recommend that applicants study beforehand. And on average, that test takes anywhere from 30 to 45 minutes. I've heard of it also taking longer, but on average, 30 to 45 minutes. And then on top of that, you would need processing time where the customer service rep would need to review your documents, take your photo, fingerprint you, and then issue you a permit, a driver's permit. That way you can actually legally now learn how to drive on the road. So that whole process on average takes about an hour. And what this is going to do is enable applicants to take the test 24/7, at home or anywhere that they can get internet connection through a desktop or laptop computer. They need a functioning keyboard and webcam. At this point in time, it cannot be done on a phone, a tablet, or a touchscreen device. So it must be a desktop or laptop computer with some kind of mouse or mouse pad. And it's the same process where the test is 30 questions and the applicant must complete the test in 60 minutes from the start of the exam.
If this is an online test, you know, the obvious question is, well, so how do you get around people cheating?
Right. So there is actually quite sophisticated security built into this system. So at the start of the test, the system will take some baseline photos. It'll ask you to look straight ahead and it'll take different angles. And it'll also instruct the applicant that they must continue to look straight at the screen at all times. So they can't look down or away. It'll actually flag them and alert them, give them two warnings if they look away or look down or, you know, are not looking straight at the camera. And after two warnings, it'll fail them on the test. So we've seen demos of this and it's actually quite impressive how, you know, you can't switch, like you can't get someone to take the test for you, you know, once those baseline photos are taken. The security should work well to prevent anyone from cheating. In addition to that, once someone passes the test, they would need to print out a certificate of completion and take it to a DMV office. That appointment time now goes from 60 minutes down to 15 or less for reviewing of documents, photo, fingerprinting, and actually issuing of the permit. So it's saving a lot of time. And as I mentioned before, this test can be taken 24/7. So it's not just office hours at a DMV. It's actually, you know, evenings, weekends, at the convenience of the applicant.
So any of our listeners on any particular island can just go online and if they have any questions, check with the county DMV?
Yes. So we have information for every county on the website, providing information about what's required, what the process is. And then also, if they have any questions regarding the system itself, then we do have online help and a phone number available so that they can call and get support.
And we are doing this because you expect a real crush in 2025 with so many driver's licenses expiring.
So 2025 enables us to start this program, optimize this program, and be prepared for 2026, where we're expecting about a 30% increase in demand for renewals. So what happened is when the city and counties switched over to an 8-year driver's license program, which was some years back, but what that did was it created these spikes in the renewals where there were a large number occurring over the span of a couple years. And so we have renewals every year. I mean, people are renewing all the time. But it created this 8-year cycle. And so this next spike in the 8-year cycle is expected to start in 2026.
Okay. And so that's why we are moving to this online system to try and deal with that crush, because the staff can't possibly handle all that.
Right. And because a written permit test takes 2 to 3 times longer to administer by DMV staff than just a renewal or just the processing if someone passed this test online, we free up a lot of appointment time, right? Because now instead of actually monitoring someone taking a test for 30 to 45 minutes and then processing them, it becomes purely just processing them in the office by taking their photo, fingerprints, reviewing their documents, and issuing the permit.
Well, I think everybody will be on board with more efficient government services.
Yeah, we're really looking forward to this. It has been something that other states have utilized. We've done our research and talked to them about how successful it's been, what some of their issues have been in trying to work through the implementation. That helped us prepare a lot more thoroughly by learning what other states had gone through, but very positive feedback from the states that I talked with. And this administration and just statewide, right, we're really trying to invest in technology to deliver better service to the public. So what that translates into for most people is reduced wait times for appointments. And when you're physically in our office, your service quickly and you're out of here in a very short amount of time. And that's always our goal.
And as far as the actual rollout of this, you know, what can people expect?
So the link for this will be available on our website. So honolulu.gov/CSD. We have a web page dedicated to this and it lists out all of the instructions that the applicant needs to set up an account and be ready to take the test and then actually take the test. And then once the test is completed, if they pass, it'll give them a link to each county website with what you have to now do next step. So you need to make an appointment. You need to bring in these documents and then you need to come in, be photographed, fingerprinted, pay your $5 permit fee for Honolulu and then get your permit. Just to talk about a little bit about the fee structure. So there is a fee to take the test online and for Honolulu it's broken down between a $2 permit test fee, which is what we currently charge in office, and then a $10 transaction fee. And so that's a total of $12 to take the test online. This is, of course, for the convenience, and it needs to cover the cost of actually administering the test through this online system. What happens is the $2 fee for the county, it goes to us. We'll get payment for that. And each county has a different fee, and then they will get that fee. So when they come in, they're not worried about the test fee itself. It would just be for the actual permit. We've been working on this for this past year. It is a pilot program that we've started, and all the counties wanted to participate in this. We will need to go through the appropriate procurement process down the road. But initially, what this enables us to do is at least get this started and see what the response is from the community. Do they like this? You know, are they, you know, happy that they can obtain services online now? And we are looking to expand this in the future with online renewals. Legislature passed a bill not long ago to actually authorize online renewals. That's taking some IT infrastructure work, but we're working to provide as much online and electronically to the public as possible, reducing the time they need to spend in the office. And hopefully in the future, you know, we'll get to a point where we can do significant services online completely.
That was Kim Hashiro, director of the city's Department of Customer Services, talking about the new online driver's license and learner's permit services that allows people to skip going to the DMV office by taking the test online on their desktop. Those services are available as of today, and we will have links on our website later today.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Chaminade University.
Hawaii's first resident Cirque du Soleil show, Awana, debuted to its first paying audiences last week. The grand opening is this weekend. And all this week, we've been airing our interviews with the show's creators to give you a behind-the-scenes look at the production. What's a show without its music? Well, earlier this year, we spoke with the show's composer, Evan Duffy, about collaborating with local talent.
It's been so amazing. I've just kind of come off about 50% of the composing process. So I'm about at the halfway point right now, which I thought was a really wonderful place to start bringing in musicians. So I've been out here for the last week recording Taimane, a bunch of other local musicians. I'm only working with musicians from the islands, which is really exciting and educational for me and just inspiring. All recording out here, like I said, at Island Sound Studios and various other places on the island. So yeah, we're just kind of like going in and we're recording some specific parts that have been, you know, written out. We're also getting a little bit hands-on in there, and I'm directing the musicians and just saying, hey, you did this thing on the last take, and that was actually really cool. What if we did this? So it's kind of molding, you know, these musicians are so brilliant that it's really easy and a luxury for me to go in there and on the fly have them try things and experiment. So that's sort of where we're at in the process. So I'm going to take those recordings back to my studio and start fitting them into the pieces and twisting them around and seeing what kind of weird sounds we can make. So it's a fun part of the process right now. Very fun.
Well, I know Taimani has this dramatic flair to her personality. And so, yeah, it's exciting to see, you know, what you folks will come up with.
Yeah, funny that we mentioned her specifically too, because early on in this process, as I began writing, I was looking for you know, in addition to the wonderful simple ukulele just strumming that is so effective, I was like, I wonder how far you can push the ukulele. And so I'm, you know, crawling TikTok and YouTube, looking for inspiration, and I come across her. And that was my introduction to her back probably in November, December of last year. And I was like, wow, I have to get in touch with her. She's such a phenomenal player. And I actually ended up writing a lot of parts in ukulele for her playing in mind. Before I even had my introduction to her, before I knew that I could get her to go in the studio and mess around, you know, it was, in a perfect world, if Taimani is interested, this is the part I would write. So then being able to actually have her represent those parts on these recordings is going to be so powerful.
Oh my gosh, she's so dynamic. I'm excited for you. I really am, because, you know, just to imagine what's possible. You've got top talent, and then you've got the incredible culture, and you want to stay, you know, true and honest, you know, and authentic. But then when you see how musicians like Taimani, you know, and artists like Mauna Ola, how they just push the envelope and just create some amazing things.
That's a huge part of the production at large. But even in my, you know, bubble of music over here, we're working so closely with like Aaron Salah and Hiva Vaughn to make sure that when we are pushing the envelope, that it's done appropriately. And even just still, it feels like a continuation of the musical traditions on the island. So like I'll have, even let's say, you know, on the furthest end of the spectrum, a really, you know, kind of driving synth part that's going under a tense moment in the show. And if you really like break that synth part out and analyze it independently, it's playing like a rhythm that you would play on like a ipuheke, or it'd be part of a hula. So we're trying to really just incorporate those traditions in every end of the process of the music, so that, you know, the people who know and care will notice those little, you know, for lack of a better word, Easter eggs, because the piece at large might not seem like it has that in it. But then, even though it feels, you know, very of the island and appropriate like that, but it's going to be everywhere, these little musical things that, you know, I hope that the people who will nerd out about that stuff, like myself, will look in there and go, hey, they cared and they did their homework. And that's like a clever way of integrating that. And yeah, so it's fun to see how far we push the boundaries, see where we get reined in. Well, it's a process and an education at the same time.
Well, we've just come off the Merry Monarch, and I don't know how much you immersed yourself and exposed yourself to just some of the incredible rhythms and the visual pageantry of the festival.
I unfortunately wasn't able to get over there to see any of it in person, but I caught some of the streams, you know. Hiva made sure that I was tuned in from my hotel room. And then being able to speak to you know, her and Aaron Salah again about this stuff regularly and just having open communication is, you know, they've told me, hey, there's no stupid questions. You can ask anything. So then, you know, sending them videos of stuff like that and saying, hey, Aaron, is this, you know, I keep noticing this and, you know, a hula or a video from Merry Monarch, you know, 3 years ago, and he'll sit me down and explain what that is and the context around it and how we can use it or how we shouldn't use it is just as important. But yeah, I'm bummed I missed it. I really want to catch it next year.
Okay. We've been listening to a conversation that we had with composer Evan Duffy when he was in town last April working on the newly opened Cirque du Soleil Awana at the Outrigger Beachcomber Hotel. We'll continue our conversation with him right after a short break.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Furniture Plus Design.
And let's return to our conversation with Evan Duffy, the composer for the new Cirque du Soleil show, Awana. We sat down with him back in April when he was in Honolulu working with local musicians on the score that blends a unique Cirque style with what makes Hawaii special.
Well, for Cirque du Soleil fans who just love the music, I mean, I've seen O and Allegra and, you know, some of it's really wild and wacky. So how do you meld, you know, what
Cirque fans are used to, and then a show like this?
Sure. Like, we stand on the shoulders of giants, sort of, right? Of how, you know, do we pay respect also to the Cirque world that's come before us? You know, it's a pretty hands-off process, and at least in the beginning, you know, Cirque is great at hiring people that they trust, of which I consider myself being very lucky to be in that pool, and that they enjoy their art. So that, you know, they really let me do my thing and then, you know, filter it through the natural creative team of our director, Neil Dorward, our producers, our cultural team. And then by the time it makes its way up to the top, they're, you know, they've been pretty excited about everything, which has been really nice. We haven't really hit any moments where they're like, hey, this is cool, but what if we did this? So I feel very trusted as an artist and a composer on this process. And I'm a huge fan of all those shows, too. Alegria and Ka. I finally got to see Ka last year in Las Vegas, and that was just a treat. So, yeah, a lot of research for the Hawaiian music side of it, but then a lot of research into the Cirque du Soleil lineage and making sure that we're also doing a continuation of that, but also not being afraid to push those boundaries as well. You know, I come from a film scoring and a songwriting background. There's so much of Cirque's music that is very cinematic, and you could drop over a film and it would be completely at home. And I think, you know, that's even more demonstrated by we've had a lot of wonderful legacy film composers do Cirque scores from, you know, a few years ago. I think there was a Danny Elfman show in Los Angeles, which was amazing. And so, yeah, it's a natural, you know, kind of tangential thing to what I'm doing most of the rest of the year on other projects. So it's a pretty easy transition. And if I weren't so trusted, it would maybe be more difficult, but I feel so taken care of over there. So they really just let me do my thing. And yeah, it's fun.
As you've just then been immersed in the culture here, what are you struck by?
I'm struck by most, which, you know, you'll get this in some other places, but not in the density that you have out here in the islands, is that everybody's a multi-instrumentalist. And not just like, oh yeah, I play a little bit of this, but they're fantastic at multiple disciplines. We're working with an amazing musician out here who's a huge inspiration, John Signor, and he, you know, makes his own nose flutes and he plays it better than anybody you've ever heard. He also plays guitar, he sings, he plays an assortment of percussion, and he's phenomenal at all that. And the other thing I've noticed is that there's so many people like that that have these incredible skills at guitar, ukulele, singing, whereas, you know, somewhere like Nashville or Los Angeles or anywhere else, you might find an incredible guitarist, but that's maybe all they focus on. They're not as an incredible songwriter, but that's what they do. They don't perform, they don't do studio stuff. So I think that says something truly about the culture traditionally, but then even current modern culture out here in Hawaii, that there's such an emphasis on musicality, and it's a heartbeat for everybody out here to say, oh, you're playing guitar today? Cool, I'll hop on the drums, the pahu or the ipuheke, and I'll do what I'm doing, and it doesn't matter. Like, I'll learn, I'll become proficient in that. So it's very intimidating how good everybody is at various things.
Well, you know, you can't have mele without ole, so how much chanting are you working in there?
Right. So that's a very exciting process for me, especially. I love vocals across the board, whether it's a pop hook or whether it's choral music like Eric Whitaker or, you know, some of the Queen's music, especially, you know, lends itself so well to choral writing. And chant especially, that's something we're very closely working with Aaron Slaw and Eva Vaughn on to make sure that, you know, we're doing it very appropriately. And that we're using it where we should use it, we're not using it where we shouldn't. The Hawaiian language, to speak to the technicality of that and how it goes into the music, is so fun to work with because it oscillates between very lyrical and it oscillates between very percussive. And so that is just, I mean, we have so many, you know, beautiful words that start with K's, for example. And that lends itself so great to, you know, a very percussive driving line. And sometimes in these acts, you know, we're taking so much inspiration from the actual artists that are going to be performing these sections of the show. Sometimes you really need to build that tension. So with a versatile language and all these wonderful meles that are pre-existing or ones that are created new for the show, it's very easy to just go, okay, here's our text and what we're trying to say, and here's the act and what that's trying to say, marry those two together and really have a vocally led moment too. So it's fun.
Well, I am excited for you, and I can't wait to see what you create on stage.
Thank you. I'm excited to share.
That was Evan Duffy, composer for the new Cirque du Soleil show, Awana. We talked to him as he was developing the music score earlier this year. And we will have links to the show on our website later today. And that's it for us right now. I'm Catherine Cruz.